Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of
What the Hell?
Okay, very good, everybody. So, but we have a serious subject this time we want to talk about. And you know, let me frame it this way. January of each year is designated as Human Trafficking Prevention Month. It's a designation issued by presidential proclamation back in 2011, and it's been every year the same way. It's a time to shine a light on the problem. It's a time to discuss what's happening to people who are survivors, but at the same time, they're victims. Mm-hmm. And so joining us right now, Mary David, who is a former prosecutor. And also, what's the name of the group you're with? Journey Out, is that right?
Journey Out.
Journey Out is a nonprofit. And Elizabeth Gegner, and your group is called Freedom...
The Freedom Ride Project.
The Freedom Ride Project. Yeah. And Freedom Ride Project is something we've talked about before. Explain that real quickly for us.
So we started in 2016, and our focus is on raising awareness about human trafficking and moving people to action in their own community. So it's very grassroots, and it's also about stopping the crime before it starts through awareness and education.
How did this come together?
Well, it started way back when I had my own personal journey of I had worked in Thailand on a volunteer basis in the 90s, and I had an almost deathly car crash with my bicycle in 2014. And I decided I wanted, and I survived it miraculously, and I decided I wanted to do something that had an impact on the world in an area where I cared about a lot. So initially when I started the foundation, we did bike rides across the United States to raise awareness. And when I first did my bike ride before I created the foundation, I thought human trafficking was something that happened overseas. You know, it happens in Thailand, it happens in very poverty-stricken areas. It doesn't happen in California, it doesn't happen in wealthy areas like Orange County. And boy, did my mind change throughout that ride, because as I did that, I met a lot of different people who told me how it's really happening here, both the sex trafficking and the labor trafficking.
When we first met, you introduced me to a woman who was a survivor, mm-hmm. who had been brought down by her John from Washington State to more wealthy Orange County, where there was potential business, mm-hmm. and she could, you know, strike up some relationships.
Yeah,
she got out of that, but it was a tough one for her, as I recall. The guy ended up being thrown in the slammer.
Right. Yeah. Well, she came on one of your shows with her daughter, who actually grew up in the home with her father being the trafficker, right, the pimp, and thinking that was what life was. That's what that was normal. And yet there were all these girls going in and out and being trafficked the whole time. And that relationship started, like they often happen, is an older boy kind of going after a younger girl, promising her all kinds of things, and then slowly luring her away from her family and her environment that's safe, and having her fall in love with him. And, you know, by the time she started to be trafficked by him, she was already in love with him, and for her, that's her boyfriend. And by that time, he had told her, "You're just trash. Nobody loves you. I'm the only one that loves you." So that kind of addictive love had happened with him, and she didn't have any place else to go but him.
You know what really sticks with me from that conversation, mm-hmm. is that if she needed diapers for the baby,
oh yeah, mm-hmm.
he'd tell her, "Well, you know how to get the money, go get mm-hmm. it."
That's what happened. I mean, the first time she was trafficked, she was actually had to move to a homeless shelter because he had slowly taken her from her home environment, and she was in a shelter. She had a newborn baby, and you know, these traffickers, they go after understanding the mindset, what are the drivers of each girl or each child that they traffic. And for her, he discovered she wanted to be a good mom. The ultimate for her was to say, "You're a bad mom." So once he knew that was the key to her heart, the key to manipulate her. When she was in there and she couldn't afford baby formula, she couldn't afford the money for the diapers, he said, "Honey, I've got this new job for you. Come on, I'll take you out and I'll show you where we can make some money for the baby." He took her on the street and he said, "Okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to walk down the street. A car is going to come up. When the guy pulls up, you want to get in the car, and this is what you're going to do with him. And he's going to give us the money to get the diapers and the formula." And she said, "No, I'd never do that. That's not me." "Aren't you a good mom? Don't you care about your child?" And that was, you know, the manipulation that started.
You know, Mary, your group is Journey Out, but also you're a former prosecutor, I believe, in Baltimore City. You're also somebody who has worked with the United Nations. In what capacity?
I was the United Nations Advisor on Women and Children's Issues for the Ambassador of East Timor.
Okay. And so what did that entail, and did that bring you in proximity with issues related to human trafficking?
Absolutely. Human trafficking is an issue that we tackled largely within countries that are, you know, particularly in southern countries that have this problem, linked a lot of times to the poverty aspect as well. And so Timor was one of those countries, and so the Global South generally, which is just a huge issue.
Well, poverty just is sort of, you have no choice. You have to do whatever you have to do in order to make money.
And I mean, it touches too on, you know, the woman that Elizabeth shared about. I mean, traffickers really are mastermind manipulators, and so they will use whatever they can by any means necessary to get a victim to comply. There is, unfortunately, there's actually a handbook that you can purchase online that lays out exactly how to entrap someone into this process.
Directions?
And for pimps.
I mean, yeah. Yes, it's a pimp handbook. Mm. And one of the things they talk about is, if you do not see a weakness in your victim, you create one. Mm. And what they do is they just systematically break a person down by devaluing them and just forcing them to see the world and themselves in just such a twisted light.
I can't get my head around the notion of a book to teach people how to be Johns.
It's outrageous. And actually, he's known as Pimping Ken, the man who wrote this. They're not webinars, but it's an online training course with modules as well that he charges for.
Where are these done out of?
Are they out
of the United States?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you have to think, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry, right? There are people moving from drug dealing to human trafficking because they can make so much money on it, and they can sell their victims over and over. A drug, you can only sell it once. But a human being, you can sell over and over, and you can get them addicted, and then you can use them to recruit and train others, right? So it's like you're creating this army of people, and you're making a lot more money with a lot lower risk.
And, you know, people often think, okay, but if it's so out there in the open, why aren't people going after them if you can just, you know, buy this thing online? But you have all kinds of issues that you run into as far as First Amendment rights. And when you're talking about actually bringing a case forward, who is your victim? What is your evidence? What do you have that says this person was trafficked by this other person? And creating that whole line is a huge struggle.
It sounds a little like those instructions online for making a bomb.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Same kind of idea that you're going to teach. It's unregulated, so I mean, there's not much that can be done.
Yeah, and one of the biggest challenge, building what you're saying, Mary, is that victims don't self-identify. So if someone's being traumatized or victimized, they don't necessarily see themselves as a victim. And so getting them to come forward, even when you're putting out these hotlines, which are great, there's a whole bunch of other things that need to happen to make sure that these victims feel safe leaving their pimps, because they've been brainwashed to think that nobody else loves them, that the police are bad, they're going to hurt them, right? So it's great that we're having this whole movement within the law enforcement for the victim-based approach, because now that's kind of starting to shift the mindset around police, around the law enforcement.
I'm interested. You've done this for what, 6 or 7 years now, give or take?
Yeah, about 5 years.
About five years. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you've been dedicated to this really consistently for quite a while. What impact do you think you've had?
I think we've had a lot of impact. Of course, our impact measures are not so much around how many people we've saved. I've actually been involved in a few cases where we were able to get girls out, and that there's a certain sense of just satisfaction or just a really good feeling to know you've helped someone get out, right?
Can you describe one of those, by the way?
Sure. But let me add this before I describe it. But my philosophy, and I come from business, that's my background, is like, where can get your biggest bang for your buck, right? And my philosophy is, if we could stop it before it starts, then we can avoid having these kids traumatized. Because when I first got involved with this, I met kids who were in Thailand who were sold into sex trafficking by their parents at the age as young as 4. And I met them when they were teenagers, and all the damage was done. That damage was never going to go away. They were never going to be able to live normal lives. Even with all the training and the counseling and the therapy, there's damage there. So my heart goes out to stop it before it starts. But going back to your question in terms of there was an incident, and I would say, prefacing this, that when you come to a point where you're helping to get someone out of trafficking, it's never just you. It's never just your organization. It takes a whole network. There's no one person that can do it all. So I actually had with Wendy, I had had lunch with Wendy, the lady that we talked about earlier in the show, and she said, you know, I hate it because whenever someone really does need help and they call one of these organizations, all the organizations, the nonprofits want to do is be able to say, we saved someone from human trafficking and put it all over their social media, but they don't help. That was her point of view. I said, well, I'm not experienced in this because I really wasn't. I'd been experienced on the prevention side. I said, but next time you get a call, call me. I'll try to help. I'll do what I can. Next day, I get a call from her. She's like, my friend is in Boise, Idaho. She's being trafficked. She's in a hotel. She's decided she wants to get out. And what I had learned is she was actually American, but what I had learned is that the Salvation Army is a place which offers shelter. So I just went where I knew. I mean, I was not an expert. I'm like, okay, I'll call the Salvation Army, and I think it was 6 a.m. It was some crazy hour. I called them. They said, we don't have any place here, but there's this other shelter down the street. So I called them, and they said, we can get her. And this is just about getting her overnight because you really want to move her out, move that person out of the geography to get them away from her pimp long term. So we were able, then I called another organization that is kind of a CIA type organization, ex-CIA people that help get victims and move them across the country. They helped me get this person. Actually, I called Rebecca Bender, who has a great organization, who was formerly trafficked. And she said, I know this great place where we can get her a home for someone that's survived and get her help out of state, far away. And then she said, you should call these other guys. And I called them, and they helped get her from that place. She went for a couple nights in Boise, Idaho, and secretly sneak her across to another state far away and get her in this place. And you don't know where these places are because they keep it secret. But that girl is now been, I've got through the grapevine, I heard, you know, she's been in the center, she's been in rehab, she's been trained, she's been worked with, and she got out of trafficking. That's a rare instance, by the way, that people are in a hotel and actually call the number and will get out like that.
So let's talk about this law. Let's talk about the new laws. Mary, you want to pick up on that? The new laws that basically say what? That you if you work in a hotel or a motel, you're supposed to be trained in what to look for?
Yes. So one of the laws requires that hotel staff receive a mandatory training of 20 minutes. And in that training, they learn what the definition of human trafficking is, warning signs to look for. They learn the national hotline and local numbers that they can call if they encounter a victim. And this is so great because hotel staff are often going to be the only people who can see and identify a victim while the exploitation is happening because they're virtually unseen to so many others.
Did you say 20 minutes?
20 minutes.
So why was my reaction, my visceral reaction to that, was that doesn't sound like very much training.
You know, I think that training can be, there's so much that that needs to be packed in when someone is, you know, learning about human trafficking. It could really, I mean, you could have an awareness training that lasted a whole week. And there would still be stuff that, you know, that you couldn't really.
A couple cover. Of points here. So the top 5 signs of sex trafficking in hotels. I'm going to read from a piece of paper here. So, pays for a room with cash or a prepaid card. That stands out as probably one of the biggest signs that there may be an issue here, right?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that comes up when a victim is trafficked is, I mean, they are usually paid in cash. And also, they want to use a form of payment that is less easily tracked. Pimps often don't. I mean, and of course, you have a whole hierarchy in terms of the levels and advantage and layers of trafficking. Some, some victims, you would never know that they were a victim because they always have their hair done and their nails done and their makeup done. And that's also part of the recruitment process. Pimps can have their girls go to nightclubs and other places looking like they are living the most glamorous life, and it works because then other people who are attracted to that say, wow, you look so amazing, and then it's a lot easier for a pimp to get other young women, for example, if another young woman who already works for him says, oh, yeah, well, this is my agent or this is my friend. You should talk to him. And now all of a sudden it's coming from a source that is one that a victim identifies with more readily or seems more like them in some capacity or what they want to be like. And so this person that they wouldn't necessarily trust initially is someone that they do actually go to.
This next item is the next sign of sex trafficking. This is interesting to me because this one sounds like you'd have to be at a flop house, that you're not going to go to a Hilton or somewhere like that and get this particular example. Chooses hourly stay or extended stay with hardly any luggage or possessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things is they will come in with, they'll have multiple girls or children that will be trafficked, right? And those, they will come in with like a Ziploc, just a bag of stuff, not with real luggage. So often there'll be only a few people checked in the room, but then there'll be a lot more people moving in and out of the room, be it the Johns or be it the victims that are being trafficked, and they won't have much luggage. So if you have someone check in with a, you know, only a few people, but you notice there's a lot more people coming in and out of there, or they check in with minimal amounts of luggage, or they check in and let's say they just book the room during the day because they're going to do their business during the day, but don't spend the night.
And then another sign is excessive foot traffic in and out of that room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What's interesting when you look at some of the trainings that are really good on this is they actually have it outlined for each of the different staff types. So someone, even for the people in the parking lot, they'll park their, the people that are doing the parking, right? They'll park their car with the license plates hidden in the other direction. They'll constantly pull up to the bellman and drop people off, but never come up in to be visible. So there's training specific for people, like what signs you look for if you're a bellman or the parking lot versus someone who might be in the services, so delivering room service, where they keep constantly having to restock the mini bar, but there's minors in the room. Like, who's drinking all the alcohol, right? And the amount of delivery of food and the amount of changing of guest services, changing
and frequent
the bed
requests also for linens and towels.
Correct.
And things like that.
And the smells that happen, you know, bodily fluids and things, you know, that are happening in the room. They should be able to distinguish that. Blood on the sheets, things like that. Yeah.
And a person's inability to say where they're from, where they live, where they anything.
Right. I mean, and also just going back to the point about. The second point
was chooses hourly stay or an extended stay.
Yes, with the extended stay and not having a lot of clothing and things like that. Sometimes that's also, you know, if they're not wearing seasonally appropriate clothing. Yeah. I mean, California, maybe it's a little harder to tell, although here I am with a coat on and everyone else is probably hot. But you know, if someone is in Idaho and it's wintertime and they're in a tank top and flip-flops and shorts, like where did they just come from and why are they wearing such minimal clothing? Mm-hmm. So it's just something to also.
It's why I wear a coat and tie all the time. I'm incognito. So here are some other signs. These are signs of, generally speaking, human trafficking. Signs of branding, like tattoos. Yeah. So if you've got somebody's name across your neck, you know, that's a way of saying this person belongs to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
But that's not always the case.
Not always the case, but you oftentimes will have someone who, you know, who has someone's name like right on their cheek. And I think especially with women, you know, when you talk about what goes on your face, I mean, that's so personal and so sensitive. And so for someone to decide to have someone's name, you know, branded across, it says a lot. And sometimes it's not just their name, you know, like they're, for example, there's a survivor who I know of, and she had King Kong's bitch tattooed. getting something like that branded on your face, it is oftentimes not a choice. And even that whole concept of choice really gets muddy, because while a part of them might be saying, well, I'm doing it because I love them and this is what they told me that they need for, you know, for me to show them that I love them, you know, that's going back to layers and layers of trauma.
Other layers on here: inability to clarify addresses, frequent runaway, homeless, or somebody in foster care, works excessively long or unusual hours. All these are signs of something may be up.
Those are for labor. That last one you stated, I'm sure that it's referring more to labor trafficking.
And labor trafficking is a little bit different. Why don't you explain that?
Well, labor trafficking is the same thing when you use force, coercion, or for someone and causing them to work for long hours, but also not paying them or not paying them adequate wages. And often they're illegals. And one of the things about that's a challenge with illegals coming over is they get these permits to work, but they only get permits to work in a specific business, right? And that business, that permit is not transferable to another business. And often the person that hires them will hold on to their paperwork, so their ID, and they're threatening them with that. So they're threatening them that I will fire you and you'll be illegal and you're going to be deported. And by the way, you can't go anywhere else because you belong to me, because you only have your permit to work in my business, right? And they'll have them work and live in these terrible conditions. Often they'll go into the back of the room where they're storing all these people, and they'll be lined up side by side with entire families working long hours. And sometimes it's a combination of sex trafficking and human trafficking. There was a case, terrible case, in I think it was in Oregon, of this very, very wealthy family. I mean, you would never imagine that they would be people that would be trafficking. They had a maid, a woman who was from, I believe, Latin America, and they were forcing her to work inordinate hours, and they also were raping her. Both the woman and the husband, and the wife were both raping her at, you know, back and forth. And eventually she met somebody that told her she could get out, and I think it was actually the gardener who helped her get out of it. And but it was just a terrible situation.
All right, so how big of a problem is this? I mean, when we talk about crimes and we talk mm-hmm. about people being used or abused, mm-hmm. what, number one, number two, number three, where does this rank?
Well, the thing is that we can say is we know it's growing. I mean, even when people will look to Polaris, for that's the best website to go to for the latest statistics, right?
And it's called?
Polaris.
Polaris.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the Polaris Project. And right now, if you go on their website, they'll have 2018 figures. And I think the newest report will probably come out in a couple months. But you can see that even from 2017 to 2018, the incidents went up 25%. It's the fastest growing illegal enterprise in the world. And Polaris tracks how many people contact them. So the hotline that people are trained to either call or that are put on these signs will give you the hotline, as well as the text, which is text be free. They have chat rooms. They basically look at how many people reported the crime. So they had, I think 2018 was 41,000 cases of human trafficking. But the estimates are that there's several hundred thousand. And people used to say figures around 400,000 U.S. kids that are being trafficked. That's not fully substantiated, but it's an estimate. And what we do know is that it's growing. Every year, it's growing.
And one thing I will say, too, about the hotline is that one problem that you really run into just in terms of demographics is that people of color often do not feel as comfortable calling into hotlines because of, you know, conceptions about whether those are linked to law enforcement and the impact that could have on their status and other things, and also just generational historical trauma and distrust of law enforcement.
Do you think that law enforcement's positioning on this, deciding that it was more of a victim, a crime involving a victim as opposed to a criminal, mm-hmm. In the case of, say, a prostitute. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's what has turned the tide?
I think it's a big element. I don't think you can identify that exclusively, but I know that the work that the Orange County Human Trafficking Council has done, is they used to take, you know, when they caught someone in the act, a John and someone who was prostitute or someone being trafficked, they would, you know, put the girl or the victim in chains and treat them like a prostitute, treat them exactly the way the pimp said that they would be treated, right? Thrown into jail or whatever and just treated terrible. But then they'd let the guy off or the the John. And now what they do is they'll take that person who's being traumatized in, they'll take them, and they have built in the police stations, they built these rooms with like nice couches, they'll offer them a tea, they have, you know, paintings on the wall that are done by survivors, and they'll say, let's have a conversation. It's a very different thing, right? And so I think they've made big strides, and I think it's a big part of the change, but we need to change on many different
fronts. What still needs to be done?
Well, I think that, for example, with this law, one of the things I'll say, I mean, we talked about it being 20 minutes. 20 minutes is a good start. But what happens in reality is one of the things that the weaknesses of this law is that there's no funding for it. So it puts all the onus of the funding on the hotels. And the biggest cost to doing this is actually not the cost of the training, because there's a lot of nonprofits that will provide the training for free. It's getting those people off work to come in and do the training. And you know, I've talked to some people, experts in this area. They estimated that there's probably 20, 25 hours of training a year per employee that's required. And you know, by the time you get OSHA standards and different trainings that they have to do, sexual discrimination. So that's a lot of time for them to be doing the training. And then because they have to save money, they're going to do online training. And I don't know if you've ever taken online training, but you know how it can be. You're just sitting at your computer and you're
like
watching,
when you take
you're watching Facebook
education,
you're right, you're watching Facebook, and then you know at the end you have a quiz, so you just go through the quiz and answer the questions. The challenge is that unless people think that training is relevant to them, and unless there's some form of reinforcement for them to change their behavior, like that means either a reward or there's a consequence that's a negative consequence, people, a lot of people won't take it seriously. So if you walk into training like that and you think, well, this only happens in Russia, it's not really happening, it's like, that's irrelevant to me, I'll just, you know, go to where they have me check the answers and not really listen to it. That's why on the television show earlier, one of the things I mentioned is that it's really important. There's training, the really good companies that do this have customized training for senior leadership, for the hotel management, for people in the different parts of the hotel, because they need different messages, right? So you need to have senior leaders. Let's say you're at a big hotel chain and you launch this. What if you had the starting of the training being the CEO of the company getting there and saying, we're taking this serious because of our brand, and these are the things that we want to market in terms of the metrics, and this is the consequences if you don't do it, and this is the rewards if you do it, right? That gives a whole different context.
It does, but don't you think as good citizens or good stewards that the hotels would want, among the other things that they have to do as well, to make sure that these things don't happen under their nose?
Of course. And that's exactly the messaging I think that the senior leadership and the heads of the hotel should be sending, like, this is happening. And you're an important piece of this. I mean, imagine you're someone who's just a housekeeper. I didn't mean to say just a, but you're a housekeeper. That's your job. What if all at once your job, you could be part of saving someone's life? And I don't mean that you're rescuing them. I just mean that you can be someone who can have an impact in your job. It elevates the potential impact that you have. So the messaging, the packaging of the training, such that people realize, gosh, this is something where I can make a difference beyond just providing good service. I can actually, you know, help people because they've seen it. What happens with this training when they start to implement it is people in the rooms, when they do it, you know, in a classroom, that's the advantage of a classroom, stories come up. We had the same instance in the high school when we started talking about human trafficking. The girls came forward and said, we have this girlfriend that's being trafficked at school. They didn't know it before because they didn't know what it looked like. They didn't know someone showing up with nice purses and jewelry and being taken away from school by an older boyfriend that was human trafficking. But now that they saw it, they're like, I know what's happening.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that's hard to define.
Yeah.
And if you just say human trafficking, what does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I think even if nothing else, having the conversation mm-hmm. out loud is helpful because it educates people.
Definitely. And it also gives people an actionable thing to do when you link it to a hotline and you give people resources. Because I think part of what makes discussing human trafficking and doing any sort of awareness a challenge and seem heavy to a lot of people is this idea that I'm just going to get inundated with all of this mm-hmm. messaging about this horrific crime that I can't do anything about, and then mm-hmm. I feel powerless, and then what do I do with all of these these emotions, and there's nothing that I can really contribute. This is all for law enforcement to handle. And that's why when you couple that with here's what you look for, here's who you can call, you really need to have these conversations with people in your life, then it just it creates more momentum and incentive to say, okay, I'm empowered and I can be an agent for change on this.
I'm glad you said that, Mary. That's one of the most important things that I learned early on in this journey is my first experience was I brought 50 of my best friends together, and I had Wendy Barnes come and share her story about being trafficked.
Wendy being the one that we have referred to a couple of times.
Everybody was sobbing in the room. People were just moved by it. They were moved. They were aware. But that didn't mean that anything happened, right? So what happens when people get awareness and training is there's around something like this is usually it's paralysis. Right. Mm-hmm. So what they need to do is you need to have people feel that they can win, that there's a way that I can make a difference. There's something tangible. So giving them the hotline to text and the hotline to call, or giving them some tools that makes it tangible and easy, gives people a sense of that they can make a difference. The other thing is once things start to happen is sharing those successes in your hotel, like in management, in employee meetings, saying, wow, this person did this, or we identified this. So bringing it into the weekly meetings that you have with people to share the successes so that you kind of get it's a culture shift, you know, kind of.
Well, this is a reminder of those four simple words that are a very easy tool, which is if you see something, say something.
Yeah.
And that really, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. If you see something that's not right, you say something to somebody who can make a difference. And whether it's something where you have to say something to a police officer, whether it's something that you have to say something to an administrator, if you see something, say something, and maybe you will be able to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Even if you're just suspicious, right? Even if you're just suspicious.
Well, it's important who they say something to and how they say something to.
Well,
right?
Tell us what to do.
So these women or these victims are often being threatened that if they talk to somebody, there's going to be consequences. So if you go talk to somebody, you could, and do it in the wrong way, you could actually cause that person to be beaten, harmed later. So that's why they provide these hotlines and that's why there should be procedures and protocols that are enforced and trained within the hotels of how you actually react to it. Versus there were some bad examples of training. I was talking to a friend of mine who owns the I-5 Network, which is an incredible training organization specialized in hotels and motels. And she was talking about some of the training she saw, and it was like the housekeeper running down the hall, chasing someone that was in that had a bruise on her face, saying, "What did he do? Who did he do it?" And then the traffickers walking right behind them, like, that's not the way to do it, right? And I don't know if the video was showing how you're not supposed to do it or how you're supposed to do it, but the way that they react is really important. So the simple thing is just knowing the hotlines to call and being able to just give it to the pros.
Do you happen to know those?
No.
Do you?
The national hotline.
Yeah. Why don't you give us those numbers out loud? And then if you're listening and you're not driving right now, grab a pen.
Well,
and if you're driving right now, when you get home, just download this episode and you can write down that phone number.
The text one is easy because you text "be free." So the letters "be free" are 233-733. But if you enter the letters "be free" in your phone, you can text to them.
B-F-R-E-E or B-E-F-R?
B-E-F-R-E-E.
Okay, got that, everybody? Be free.
Uh-huh. Okay. And when you do that, you'll start a chat conversation. And people that are victims, that's the one that they use the most frequently because it's less dangerous for them. And then the 800 number is 1-888-373-7888. I'll repeat it, okay?
Yeah, a lot of eights there. Easy to remember.
1-888-373-7888.
One way that helps me remember that one is you just think eights are on all the ends and you just have 3737 in the middle.
That's good.
Look how clever you are.
Super smart. Well, I'm just saying it makes it really easy.
What the hell? Yeah.
What the hell?
So, all right, let's last words. Let's start with Mary. Final thought,
human trafficking awareness is something that everyone needs to be involved in, and that's in so many different capacities. Whether or not you're hotel staff, there are resources. Good On You is an app where you can check for seeing if, you know, the clothes that you make and the food that you buy, what kind of labor supply chains are sourcing those things. And so I just want to encourage people to think outside the box in terms of what advocacy means, because there's a whole gamut of things and we need advocates everywhere.
Elizabeth?
I would say just adding on to the law that we still need more legislation and we need a lot of work on the enforcement, because right now there's nothing to enforce that law. Basically, you'd have to sue the establishment and they would get a punishment of $500 the first time and $1,000 the second time. So we really need to work on the enforcement side of it. And I think it's a great start, but I think it takes a lot more in terms of putting some consequences in place for places that don't do this.
Is it fair to say, though, that when you have a start, it's easier to build?
Absolutely. No, it's great. Yeah.
All right. Elizabeth, Mary, thank you very much. Mary
Thanks
David,
for
Elizabeth
having
Gegner.
Us.
And my last word, besides what the hell, is if you see something, say something. Right? All right. Okay. Thanks for joining us for this episode of What the Hell. And you know, if you haven't already subscribed, please do. Right. What the hell?
What the hell?
All together. Ready?
What the hell?
See you next time, everybody.